Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting new developments about Ebola in West Africa. There is celebration in Liberia this day after the World Health Organization said the West African nation is now free of Ebola after going 42 days, twice the maximum incubation period for the deadly disease, without any new cases. While celebrating the milestone, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf on Saturday told the Associated Press the damage wrought by the worst Ebola outbreak in history was a scar on the conscience of the world. Meanwhile, new cases were reported this week in neighboring Sierra Leone and in Guinea, the other two countries hit hardest by Ebola. For this reason, officials said they are cautious about openly celebrating the end of Ebola in Liberia. Egypt's deposed leader Hosni Mubarak and his two sons were sentenced Saturday to 3 years in prison and a fine in a retrial on corruption charges they faced earlier. It was not immediately clear whether or not it will include time that the former leader has already served since his country's 2011 revolt. The corruption case, dubbed by the Egyptian media as the presidential palace's affair, concerns charges that Mubarak and his two sons embezzled millions of dollars worth of state funds over the course of a decade. The funds were meant to pay for renovating and maintaining presidential palaces, but were instead allegedly spent on upgrading the family's private residences. South Korean military officials say North Korea has test-fired 3 anti-ship cruise missiles into the sea one day after warning it would strike South Korean vessels without notice if they intrude on its territory. This is VOA News. The United States has threatened to impose sanctions on individuals in Burundi who were fueling election-related violence. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said the government of Burundi has a window of opportunity to bring the violence to a halt.
Following the third meeting in the past month on the escalating violence in Burundi, Ambassador Power told reporters that the international community has urged President Pierre Nkurunziza to put his people ahead of his personal desire to seek a third term.
I think the message from the international community was loud and clear, and it's a message that he has chosen not to hear.
Opposition parties and protesters say that by seeking re-election, the president is violating a two-term limit in the Constitution. The Constitutional Court ruled otherwise on Tuesday. However, Ambassador Power said a lack of judicial impartiality led to that decision.
That is Margaret Bashir reporting from United Nations headquarters in New York. Spanish officials have confirmed at least 3 people are dead in the crash of a military plane near Seville's airport. Spain's Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy said Saturday up to 10 crew members were on board the new Airbus A400M. The aircraft was under flight trials at the airport but had not yet been delivered to the Spanish military. Airport authority AENA said that Seville Airport had been closed and its fire crews went to the crash scene outside the airport perimeter. Flights to Seville were being diverted to nearby airports, said the authority. An amateur video showed thick black smoke rising from the site north of Seville's San Pablo Airport. Saturday is a national day of mourning in Pakistan following the helicopter crash Friday that killed 7 people, including the ambassadors to Pakistan from the Philippines and Norway, as well as the wives of the ambassadors of Malaysia and Indonesia. 3 crew members were also killed in the crash. Authorities say the bodies are now at an airbase in Rawalpindi. Officials say the helicopter with at least 17 people aboard crash-landed Friday in Naltar Valley in northern Pakistan. An army spokesman said on Twitter that the ambassadors of Poland and the Netherlands were among the survivors. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for downing the aircraft. However, the defense minister said the crash occurred purely due to a technical fault and not because of any terrorist actions. A car bomb has exploded in Baghdad's central Karada area, killing at least 8 civilians and wounding 28. That according to police. Among the dead, Shiite pilgrims preparing for next week's major event commemorating the anniversary of the 8th century death of a reverend religious figure, Imam Musa al-Kazim. Local residents helped firefighters at the scene of the blast to extinguish the vehicles. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
The United States is very carefully monitoring the situation, and we are prepared to take targeted measures, including visa bans or sanctions, against those who plan or participate in widespread violence.
The United States threatens to impose sanctions on Burundians who are fueling election-related violence.
What we've done now is to engage with the public, to engage with the communities that are being targeted by the terrorists.
Ugandan military launches a de-radicalization campaign to stop terrorist groups from recruiting the country's youths.
We cannot accept that killing against our partners of MONUSCO because they came here to help for peace.
And the United Nations mission says it will not cooperate with the DRC in the fight against the FDLR rebels. We'll have a reaction from the government. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The United States threatened Friday to impose sanctions on individuals in Burundi who are fueling election-related violence. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir reports from New York that U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said the government of Burundi has a window of opportunity to bring the violence to a halt.
Following the third meeting in the past month on the escalating violence in Burundi, Ambassador Power told reporters that the international community has urged President Pierre Nkurunziza to put his people ahead of his personal desire to seek a third term.
I think the message from the international community was loud and clear, and it's a message that he has chosen not to hear.
Opposition parties and protesters say that by seeking re-election, the president is violating a two-term limit in the Constitution. The Constitutional Court ruled otherwise on Tuesday. However, Ambassador Power said a lack of judicial impartiality led to that decision. She pointed to the testimony of the vice president of the Constitutional Court, who fled to Rwanda this week, saying the judges were subjected to tremendous pressure and even death threats. The U.S. envoy said Washington is ready to take a firm stance against those behind recent street fighting in Burundi's capital.
The United States is very carefully monitoring the situation, and we are prepared to take targeted measures, including visa bans or sanctions, against those who plan or participate in widespread violence of the kind that we all fear.
The UN Refugee Agency says since pre-election violence erupted late last month, more than 50,000 people, mostly women and children, have fled Burundi to neighboring Rwanda, Tanzania, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ambassador Power said the violence must be stopped and peaceful protests allowed.
To date, neither President Nkurunziza nor his government has condemned the violence by the youth militia or called for restraint by the police. We urge them to do so immediately. Failure to take these steps will only heighten the scale of violence and increase the risk of this turning into a regional crisis.
The United Nations has dispatched Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region, Said Jinnah, to Burundi, where he's working with stakeholders in an effort to stabilize the situation. African leaders are also trying to calm the political tensions. Next week, leaders from the five-nation East Africa community will meet in Tanzania to discuss the situation. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Meanwhile, Burundians are voting with their feet as pre-election violence in their country escalates. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 50,000 people have fled in fear to neighboring countries during the last several weeks, and this seemingly unstoppable flow is increasing. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has this report from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is worried that one of the most promising refugee return and integration programs in Africa could unravel because of the crisis in Burundi. Burundi's decade-long civil war, which ended in 2005, sent hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing to neighboring countries. After peace returned, the UNHCR helped almost 500,000 of them return to their homes. Neighboring Tanzania not only has played host to many of these refugees, but is also sheltering large numbers of Burundians who had fled violence in 1972. UN refugee spokesman Adrian Edwards says, in recent years, Tanzania has offered citizenship to some 200,000 of these refugees and their descendants. He says this is the largest refugee integration program ever enacted by a host country.
Since the eruption of pre-election violence in mid-April, however, there have been alarming signs that this progress is being undone. Over the last weeks, more than 50,000 Burundians have fled to Rwanda, Tanzania, and Democratic Republic of the Congo. Many of these have crossed into Rwanda, but over the last week, we've also seen a big increase in people seeking asylum in Tanzania after entry restrictions there were lifted. In addition, almost 8,000 people have crossed into South Kivu province in DRC.
Violent clashes between police and protesters broke out in mid-April after Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza, who has been in power since 2005, announced he was planning to seek a third term. Opponents say this violates the terms of the 2000 Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement that limits the president to two terms. Opponents are calling for the June 26th presidential elections to be postponed. Although the African Union supports this demand, President Nkurunziza shows no signs of backing down. UNHCR spokesman Edwards says a majority of the refugees are women and children, including a large number of unaccompanied children. He tells VOA many of these people say they have experienced difficulties while trying to leave Burundi.
What I've been saying in Burundi is that people have difficulties because of the security situation. What we're hearing is multiple roadblocks of women in particular having problems getting past these, threats of rape, other problems. Borders at the moment are open to other countries, but it's vital they remain so. People fleeing violence and fear of violence clearly need access to safe havens.
Meanwhile, the World Food Programme warns the political crisis in Burundi could lead to a humanitarian crisis. Right now, the WFP says it is providing food and nutrition to more than 25,000 Burundian refugees in Rwanda. The WFP says it and its partners are preparing to assist up to 100,000 refugees in Rwanda if necessary. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A spokesman for the Ugandan People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, says the army has launched a de-radicalization campaign. The goal is to thwart recruitment drives by terrorist groups, including the Somali-based Islamist group Al-Shabaab. Colonel Padiankunda says the move came after the Allied Democratic Front, a terrorist group, began recruiting radical youths for Al-Qaeda in the region. He told me the UPDF aims to stop the terrorist recruitment by educating the population about activities of the terrorist group.
Well, this is targeting areas where those who have been recruiting terrorists and would be radicals have been operating from, and this is particularly in areas of central Uganda. What we've done now is to engage with the publics, to engage with the communities that are being targeted by the terrorists, through campaigns in the media to ensure that we show them the dangers of getting involved in radical activities. Particularly, we have one specific group, the ADF, the Allied Democratic Front, which has been recruiting radicals on behalf of Al-Qaeda. And we are targeting areas where they have been trying to recruit to sensitize the population so that they are aware that this device has no head.
Colonel, recently President Museveni, Yoweri Museveni, had talks with U.S. Secretary, high U.S. official Susan Rice.
How would America's help, or how would Washington's help, or strengthen your move in this fight against terrorism?
Well, terrorism being what it is, and the way that it cuts across the borders, it knows no capital. I think the partnership between Uganda and the United States is very, very critical, considering the role that we are playing in the region to deal with these radical characters, right from Somalia through to dealing with the Allied Democratic Forces and the Lord's Resistance Army in operating now in Central African Republic. With the Lord's Resistance Army, we think that the partnership has yielded so far so much, including the recent surrender of Dominic Ongwen and his handing over to the International Criminal Court. And we appreciate the United States' support, I think, stands out above all the other countries as being very consistent in supporting those willing African partners to fight terrorism. I think this is working out very well, and we should encourage it.
How about the issue of human intelligence? How do you gather information on these armed groups who often carry out violence against unarmed civilians in various parts of, if not only Uganda, your neighboring countries like Central African Republic, Congo Kinshasa, Burundi, all those places that you are accustomed to?
Well, the beauty of these characters is that they are not aquatic. They don't live on water. They live within the community. So what we have done as a region and as a country is create regional mechanisms of networking that bring together regional actors, intelligence agencies, in order that we can get actionable, timely, and accurate intelligence about these movements. Recently, we captured 8 Somali characters who confessed that they had been preparing to attack Kampala. We recovered explosive materials from them here in Kampala, and they said they had moved all the way through Kenya. We managed to capture them based on the intelligence that we picked from our colleagues in Kenya. So these mechanisms are working. I think we should strengthen them further and coordinate intelligence across the borders and share it on a timely basis so that when these characters cross the border, they can be tracked.
I understand the UPDF has also begun a move to win the hearts and minds of the places where they served in countries such as South Sudan and elsewhere, Somalia and all that, by building health centers and engaging the population in that directive. What can you tell me about this move?
Well, the success and the beauty of UPDF is that we fight with the people. Winning hearts and minds is part of our doctrine. It is anchored in our discipline and in our ideology as a nation. Now, we've been doing this not only in South Sudan, but in all the theaters where we operate, in Somalia and in Central African Republic. We create community-based networks that help in providing popular intelligence right from the community. Now, this is the bond that keeps us together, because the people are aware that they need security, but we cannot provide it if we don't have information about those who tend to take it away. And I think this is working very well. The struggle of winning hearts and minds, the struggle of a disciplined force, not only in Uganda but in the region, must be supported. Otherwise, without disciplined forces, there will be no regional peace and security.
Kenel Pandiankunda is the spokesman for the UPDF. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, Ugandans have until Monday to register for next year's general election. This follows an extension by the country's electoral body after a number of people said they need more time to register. Charles Mwanguya is the communications director of Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Kampala to check on the progress of the voter registration process.
The Electoral Commission hasn't provided us as yet or announced to the country what the actual progress is. What we have seen is that they have announced two extensions after they had insisted that the first period from the 7th until the 23rd of April wouldn't be extended. And the assumption that we are making is that they realized that the exercise hasn't been as smooth as they had expected, and they weren't recruiting the number of new voters or getting enough voters on the register to verify their details on the register. That's why they announced the two extensions. But they have not yet come out to say we have so far verified this number of voters, or we have registered this number of new voters, and the expectation is so many more voters that are still out there, or those both for those who have either come to verify or those who have come to register as new voters.
Charles, there had been allegations that the Electoral Commission intended to use the register for the national identity cards. Has that been resolved?
Clearly, the Electoral Commission finds itself caught in between two processes. One is that the government intended to generate a national ID database. So there was a process last year that registered Ugandans for the national ID called the National Security Information System registration process. What government said at the time was that national ID had no relationship with the national voters register development, because they operate under two different laws. The Electoral Commission is required by the Electoral Commission Act to independently generate a national voters register. The problem with using data from the national ID is that the process was handed over to the Ministry of Internal Affairs. The Ministry of Internal Affairs is headed by a serving military officer, and very many critics of that data say he is on deployment to deliver a voters register that will guarantee President Yoweri Museveni, the incumbent, another victory. And the Electoral Commission finds itself caught in between. It hasn't come out to clearly separate the process through which it is using the national ID data to develop the national voters register. Because recently they announced that they are retiring. The EC announced that it is retiring the old registers that was used in the 2011 elections to generate a new voters register. And that is causing quite a bit of controversy. Though the official explanation from the Electoral Commission is that they are using the national ID data to verify citizenship, which would be understandable. But there's a lot of mistrust around that area, and I do not think it will be going away anytime soon.
So, and all this happens amidst calls for electoral reforms by the opposition and civil organization societies. Where does this leave the confidence of the people in the whole electoral system?
It's a big battle the Electoral Commission in Uganda has to deal with, but the government generally has to deal with. It's guaranteeing the confidence in the process that delivers elected officials in this country, guaranteeing the confidence created by the belief or the desire to have an independent Electoral Commission and the transparent process that delivers the elections in this country is a major concern. And that is why a lot of criticism has come about the national voters register development process. It is important. As the Students' Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda said, we've been mobilizing voters and telling them it's important that you get yourself onto the national voters register. It is important that people confirm or have the guarantee that they are on the register, regardless of how they intend to use that right in future.
Charles Mwangui is the Communications Director for Citizens' Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kampala. The Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister says the country's army has intensified its military offensive against the Allied Democratic Forces. Originally from Uganda, the rebels are blamed for the recent killing of two Tanzanian soldiers. Lambert Mende told me that the government is determined to root out the armed group in a bid to protect life and property of unarmed citizens in parts of the country where the rebels often operate.
After the killing of these two soldiers from Tanzania, we have decided really to finish that the remaining of this armed group from Uganda is ADF NALU, because they are causing a lot of mess in that region, and we cannot accept that killing against our partners of MONUSCO, because they came here to help for peace. So that is why we have decided to enhance our offensive against them. And we are very far now, deeply engaged in the forest, and we have discovered a lot to follow them and destroy all their last remnants. And we are doing it with big success. And the number three of the ADF was killed, I think, 1 week ago. And we hope that this group will be finished very, very soon.
We also heard reports coming from MONUSCO that they are willing to go it alone in the fight against some of these armed groups in parts of the country. What is your government reaction to that?
As far as FDLR is concerned, I think they are well aware of what opposed us and why our government took the decision not to cooperate with them. They know very well why. And it is to them to meet all these reasons we gave why we were not happy. So if they want to go by themselves, it is not forbidden. I think it is one of the mandates that was given to them by the UN resolution. But we have given reasons why we refuse to cooperate with them about FDLR. If these reasons are met, I think things can change. But since these reasons have not yet met, so why not? They can go by themselves as we are going by ourselves.
Well, Honorable, wouldn't this supposed misunderstanding or disagreement between your government and MONUSCO really give this FDLR enough breathing room to perhaps escape from the military pressure that together you are putting on them?
Only someone who is not well aware of the situation, the ongoing situation, can think that FDLR can be given a chance. I think they are disappearing, and we have neutralized more than half among them. I think the offensive is well going, but about our problem with our partners of MONUSCO, things have not yet changed. So things must change. They have to reconsider the situation. But if this situation is not put on the table by them, so let's go by the, each one on its way. So I think this is not something that we have to lose time with.
What is the most critical part of your reasons that you think the MONUSCO should meet before any cooperation between your government or your forces and MONUSCO to continue with this military offensive that you've been undertaking for quite a while now?
We have talked a lot about it. Our head of state have already said about it. I'm not going to repeat. We need only respect. We need our army be respected. We need our country be respected by our partners. You can't cooperate with someone and lack respect to him. We said something. We need to be understood, and that's all. I'm not there to repeat what has been said. Everybody is aware.
Lambert Mende is the Information Minister for the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, political satire from the African diaspora, poking fun at political and religious figures and symbols can make you laugh, but it can also stir up a great deal of controversy. Straight Talk Africa comes to you on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. Join the discussion. That's next time on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
The way you move in your body from left and right, you know we love you. And they pump, you gotta make them look at you. Everybody just feeling you, mama, mama, just feeling you. Baby, mama, 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 go like to the balaga. Chop the banana, oh, mama, chop the banana. Banana, ah. Baby, right in your way. Baby, right in your way. Baby, right in your way.
baby. She dey wild like tsunami. She fight like Victoria Kimani. She got an amati. If I move, you move Versace. Give her tea. Don't let go of Cavalli. My niggas don't know I know that. My niggas don't know like I'm a guy. See the way that she go down. Number one on the condom. Me a moti de. Oya kai de. Oya palan de.
looking for my honey. You telling me this, you telling me that. I say this is not for me. Johnny do me funny. Johnny do me funny. He's doing me this, he's doing me that. But I know what them on me. He go Canada, he go Tokyo. Yesterday he say he dey Morocco. He dance the sicko, he sing a wino. Na lie, na lie, na Pinocchio. This one I go be. I got original go be.
From the continent, we hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. And I simultaneously try to look at African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. This week, the most significant development with regard to state building and nation building in Africa is Burundi. 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 Burundi is now remembered by many Americans during the time of President Clinton when we had the crisis in Rwanda and, of course, Burundi. Two geopolitical units in Africa which go back to colonial times when the competing European powers carved out the Republic of now called the Democratic Republic of Congo, Congo Brazzaville, and then you have these two smaller units, Rwanda and Burundi. Today, African leaders who have been struggling since Kwame Nkrumah invited all of them to Ghana are the Organization of African States, without a name, later called the Organization of African Unity in Addis Ababa. And since then, we have the African Union. Much has been done by Africans in state building and nation building. Today, geopolitically speaking, we have the state of Rwanda, we have the state of Burundi. These two geopolitical units have much in common, and their situation parallels what is happening in South Sudan, what is happening in Somalia, and what is happening in many other countries. It is the question of ethnicity and politics and how ethnicity affects state building and nation building. Both Rwanda and Burundi are now considered members of the United Nations. They were recognized by the world community as members of the African Union as well as members of the United Nations. The issue I want to address today is the question of term limits and how term limits is affecting all these African countries. Term limits was a big bone of contention in Nigeria during the last days of former President Femi Awolowo, when Awolowo was the leader of the opposition in Nigeria. There were dissident groups in other parts of what was considered Western Nigeria. And of course, it led to a crisis. And, of course, in the end, Awolowo was put in jail. And that crisis of ethnicity, time limits within political parties, led to major crises in Nigeria, and it eventually led to a civil war, and the rest is now history. That was why when former Nigerian President Obasanjo wanted to have an extension of his term, you have a big crisis in Nigeria. That crisis in Nigeria came back during the time of Jonathan. And these echoes of term limits, ethnicity and political rivalry, regionalism, federalism, will spread all over the continent. Because now in Burundi, we go back to square one. We have the question of term limits. The president of Burundi has succeeded in doing something Obasanjo couldn't do. He has taken advantage of the Nigerian situation to say that his country doesn't have a problem. But the evidence against him are overwhelming. Number one, 50,000 people from his country left the country because of the fear of violence in his country. Yet he still wants to have term limits. He wants to be extended. The United States government is against him. The African Union is against him. But he is willing to face the consequences. This takes you back to comparative African politics. You have the problem of Gbagbo in Ivory Coast, where you have a big struggle between him. One of the Ivorians who worked in the Congo and in Rwanda during the same crisis put out a book calling it Two Presidents, talking two presidents in Ivory Coast. Now you have President Ouattara, who was the bad guy during the time of Didier, when you have ethnicity, regionalism as the bone of contention. Today, the Ivorians are going full circle, and they're trying to build bridges to work out a new deal among themselves. The Rwandese are still struggling with their problem after the bloody civil war. As Americans tend to immortalize this African crisis with a Hollywood video in Rwanda, Hotel Rwanda. The same rivalry, ethnicity or clanism as in Somalia is now immortalized in American politics through Black Hawk Down. This is how state building and nation building in Africa is beginning to affect all these countries. The Senegalese were caught in the same fix when President Watt wanted to do the same thing Obasanjo tried to do in Nigeria. And that is the big problem for all these African countries where you have former presidents grooming their children and bringing dynastic politics, creating more crises for political succession in individual African countries. This takes us back to the problem in Burundi. When you have refugees fleeing from Burundi to Rwanda, you heighten the stakes in Rwanda. When you have refugees fleeing to the Congo, you adding flame in the Congolese crisis. And you creating problem for succession. And the big problem emerging in Africa today is those who govern are very reluctant to hand over power to political opposition. This is my lesson for Africa today. The Burundians, please wake up and smell the coffee.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, every morning you have two choices. Continue to sleep with your dreams or wake up and chase them. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. According to the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, last year over 51 million people were living as refugees from war or persecution. In the past decade, most refugees came from Asia and the Pacific. But today, the Middle East and North Africa are the main regions of origin of refugees. For the first time, there are more displaced people than after the Second World War. That's partly because there are more new conflicts, but the old ones are not going away, and instead are becoming chronic, said Catherine Wiesner, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Population, Refugees, and Migration. And they've become more brutal. Civilians aren't just getting caught in the crossfire. They are being deliberately and indiscriminately killed as warring parties lay siege to neighborhoods, burn villages, and even target hospitals and schools, said Deputy Secretary Wiesner. International humanitarian principles are being trampled. Boundaries once honored, even in wartime, have been crossed. The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration is tasked with providing protection, easing suffering, and resolving the plight of persecuted and uprooted people around the world. Wherever uprooted people flee, we and other agencies strive to adapt, to identify the greatest threats and needs, and devise new ways to protect the most vulnerable refugees, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Wiesner. This includes programs to protect them from perils commonly faced by refugees and displaced people, including gender-based violence, human trafficking, and exploitation by criminals who prey on the vulnerable. The United States funds schools and recreation centers for children, as well as vocational training for youth and adults, so that whether they eventually return home or settle in a foreign country, they will have the skills to get well-paying jobs or start new businesses of their own. The best solution to mass displacement isn't local integration or resettlement, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Wiesner. It is not more humanitarian aid. It is addressing the root causes of the violence that drives so many people from their homes. The United States and its partners are committed to helping resolve conflicts, build democratic and just societies. Until then, we are working to safeguard refugees' lives and their dignity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.